Time for a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. He comes by the first Wednesday of every month to talk with us about what's going on in the outdoors and certainly to answer your questions as well, and I hope you'll join in. Virtually every line is filled, but let me give you the number for future reference, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And Scott, welcome to the program. We're having a little trouble with his headphones here. Are those working?
Well, I can hear you because I'm only 2 feet from you, but the headphones are not working.
That's going to be a problem. Let's check the volume there. Is that volume? Is the volume helping at all?
No, the volume is not helping.
But
we'll see.
We'll see what happens. Tell you what, let's talk a little bit before we go to the phone, since you won't be able to hear the calls. let's talk a little bit about what you've been up to in recent times here. I know you had last Saturday, I believe you had a little trip with...
Well, it's a busy time of year with the end of the semester. Last class day is on Friday, of course, so in some ways that's a welcome event every spring. But we had a field trip with my vertebrate ecology class on Saturday morning and spent an entire day with the class in a bus out on the lower Wisconsin Riverway. And we actually came up with some, despite the fact that it was rather cold and gloomy, at least through most of the day, and we seem to have solved our technical problem now.
There was a button that I never had to push before, but Joy Cardine came in and pushed it for me.
Okay, we're in good shape now. Anyway, we spent the day with about 50 students out on the lower Wisconsin Riverway in various sites looking for reptiles and amphibians. And it was pretty slim pickings until about noon when it warmed up a little bit, and we ended up on a prairie site that's known as a research or study site for rare ornate box turtles.
Cool.
And the students were successful at finding four of those. And the interesting thing was the property manager was on site and helped us out, and he had the records for those turtles. One of them had not been seen since 2000, so it had vanished for 7 or 8 years. And the first encounters for all of those turtles, which are marked with a little numbering system, for research purposes, the first encounters were back in 1991.
Wow.
So the students came, how old are these turtles anyway? I said, well, you know, I don't know. They probably could be 20, 30, 40 years old. Assuming that some of them were probably adult or older turtles when they were first encountered, some of them probably were 20, 30, 40 years old. And the students got a big kick out of that. And just holding an endangered species and contributing to a research project is a good thing. And then we ended up catching a couple of really big bull snakes.
They were really big ones.
And they were docile in the cool weather. And the students got a chance to examine them closely and get pictures taken and so forth. So all in all, it ended up to be a pretty good day, and we had a good time.
And lots of birds coming to your feeder before we go to the phone. We've got half a dozen Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah, my Orioles came back about a week ago, and we got the oranges and the jelly out there. Now we're going through jelly at a fantastic rate. But I really like to see the Orioles. We have a couple of rose-breasted grosbeaks as well, which are very pretty. Unfortunately, I found a dead adult in the garden last night when I went out to rototill, so that one will become a specimen. Don't know what happened to it, but it was dead nevertheless. But the goldfinches are very pretty this year. I mean, you get an oriole, a goldfinch, a rose-breasted grosbeak, a blue jay, and a cardinal at the feeder at the same time. That's pretty much a kaleidoscope of bird life. So it's a great time to be doing those kinds of things, and it's just a great time for wildlife activity in general.
You betcha. Robert in West Allis has a question for you, so let's go to Robert. Hi, Robert. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Well, I have a little visitor that comes to visit us. And it's either called a hedgehog or a groundhog or a woodchuck, whatever they call it. In any event, he's coming and visiting our bird feeder, sharing that nice little goodies with the birds and with the squirrels. So, but anyway, the question I have is, I don't know, I think he might also be eating some of the blossoms or some of our tulips. But I was wondering how, if I wanted to stop that nuisance of this guy, what would you recommend?
Well, first of all, groundhog or woodchuck are the appropriate terms. That's the animal in question. Hedgehog is a Eurasian species dealt with in the pet trade. It's got spines all over it, but let's just call it a woodchuck for the time being.
Excuse me.
And Larry's very experienced with dealing with these things around his yard. They can be a major gardening nuisance, but I think it's worthwhile to say up front that with any of these animals we tend to talk about, whether it's woodchucks or rabbits or deer or any of the other animals that can cause people some grief around their yard, if they're not causing some grief, and you can protect your plantings with fencing or repellents or other tactics that are available and still have the animals around, you know, our preference is to promote the positive values of these things. And if they're not causing a problem, you know, generally there's no need to go out of your way to remove them. In other words, peaceful coexistence is what we strive for here. However, if the woodchuck is causing you problems, and it's highly likely that it will, and those problems get to a level that you're not willing to tolerate in exchange for, you know, seeing the animal around or enjoying its behavior or activity, then you've got several choices with the woodchucks. The first of which is to attempt to protect what you'd like to protect. The problem with woodchucks is they're great diggers, they're accomplished climbers. It's very hard to physically exclude a woodchuck from anything you want to protect. So you usually have to go to something a little more direct. They can be caught in a cage trap or live trap, as they're sometimes called, and moved if you've got a place that's an appropriate home for it. That's one alternative. If you have to go the more direct route, of course, in a rural area or an area where it's safe to do so, they can be hunted or controlled on your own land year-round, even though they're otherwise a protected species. So someone in the countryside might choose to shoot one. That's legal
and can be done.
And there are also some fumigation cartridges, looks like a big firecracker that garden centers, hardware stores would carry, that are lit like a big firecracker and put down the animal's burrow, if you know where that is, and then cover the burrow, and that serves to fumigate the burrow system and deal with them that way. So those latter alternatives are lethal. If that's not the way you want to go, then your choices are to try and protect the plantings as best you can, or to remove the animal alive and relocate it.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Alice in Wind Lake is up next. Alice, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I think the DNR turkey bus came to our property. The morning of March 20th, there were 15 wild turkeys in my yard.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, unfortunately, we had a foot of wet, heavy snow that closed the Milwaukee airport. That was Good Friday. And one question I have is I wonder how well they survive, you know, a lot of snow that would hang around for a few days. And now I've been seeing on a regular basis two or three females and one male, and they like to stand in my bare garden, which I haven't started planting yet. And I'm wondering, when I do start, you know, I plant my garden seeds and the sprouts start coming up, am I gonna have an issue with them pulling up the new sprouts and kind of ruining my vegetable planting?
Probably not. I mean, there are some raps on turkeys in terms of bothering silo bags and scratching around in grain fields and so forth. But I've heard very few, if any, problems where a home gardener might be agitated. Despite the fact that they've been hanging around the yard, they're fairly wary. And I think if you take a more aggressive approach at disrupting them when you see them, I think you can solve any problems you might have, and I don't think you'll have any anyway in that manner.
Okay, so you don't think I need to fence the garden or anything like that?
Well, fencing is for something that can fly as well as they can. The fencing isn't probably going to help very much, but on a smaller garden, a short fence may be enough to just encourage them to walk around it rather than fly in there unless there's something they really want. The larger flocks you saw earlier are typical of winter behavior. They aggregate in huge flocks, sometimes hundreds of birds, and then disperse. Those flocks break up. The gobblers or adult toms go about their business scattered across the countryside, and the hens split up to mate and then go off and nest, which they're doing now. So the big group you saw was a function of winter conditions, and they're now split up and scattered across the countryside, as you indicated.
So it probably wasn't the DNR just releasing?
No.
They don't release. We're pretty well through moving turkeys around the landscape.
Okay.
They've done that on their own. So what you saw was a normal resident flock, and those 15 or 20 birds are now broken up in either singles or a couple birds here and there, as you observed in your garden. As far as the snow is concerned, turkeys all over Wisconsin were exposed to months of deep snow this winter and seem to have come through it pretty darn well.
Yeah, they're fun to see in the yard.
They're long-legged. They can fly. They're very powerful birds for scratching for food. So a few days of wet snow in the spring are no problem at all.
Good luck. Thanks very much for calling, Alice. Appreciate your call. Lots of callers online. Let's go to Doug in Oshkosh next. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Larry Scott. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I mean, I've been on Oshkosh quite a while, and all of a sudden white pelicans with the black tips, and how do they get here, and why are they here, and do they nest here, or, I mean, I couldn't believe it. A couple of years ago, I thought, that's a pelican, you know, by the way they fly, you can tell it very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it, where do they come from, and what's the deal?
Well, they're a native bird. They pass through on migration anyway, but a nesting issue has been a relatively recent phenomenon, particularly the growth of a pretty substantial colony in Lower Green Bay just outside the mouth of the Fox River on an island where there are hundreds of pairs nesting now, and it's my impression they're also dispersing to some of the larger inland lake systems, probably like Winnebago, Horican Marsh, and so forth. And there were some peculiar things going on a couple of years ago where some huge – generally, they're a bird that was found to the west of us from central Manitoba down through the Dakotas and areas like that. And there were some huge colonies on national wildlife refuges in the Dakotas. And I don't remember the specific one that where literally a number of thousands of pelicans just kind of up and vanished a couple summers ago during the nesting season. And that seemed to be concurrent with the appearance of and growing colonies in some other parts of the northern tier of states. And whether they're some of the same birds or not, I'm not sure. But the bottom line is they're a native species. They've been here in the past. They're here now. And the population seems to be increasing. They're a spectacular bird to see because they're so darn large. And when a line of them flies over, kind of soaring by, it's like a squadron of bombers. But I suspect it's a sight. The presence of white pelicans with increasing frequency will be something Wisconsin residents will be getting used to.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Doug. They are fun to watch, and fun to watch them fish, too, when they dive into the water. Melody in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Mel.
Hi. I'm right now just looking at a bunch of Canada geese with some goslings. There's a particular problem with a crow in Waukesha. It's on Grand Avenue. It looks like it has a fractured wing. Can't catch him because he's incredibly fast. And I've tried to get him help. What would you suggest we do with him? I know they live a long life. They're a very smart bird. And I just hate to see his demise under a bus or a wheel or a cat or a dog.
Yeah.
Well, that's a tough one. I understand your concern, and they are a very capable bird. There are folks who are kind of down on crows because of perceived depredation on songbirds and scavenging and noise and a few other things. But you never like to see an injured anything. Is local animal control or Humane Society or Nature Center, are folks like that aware of this crow, or is this something you've kind of taken on as an individual cause?
Well, I have alerted now. There's an outfit out, Wildlife Rehabilitation Center out on sea, going towards the Conemaugh, and I've let them know. If I can get him, I will, and I'll take him to that area. We just have such a wonderful diversity of birds in Waukesha. You talked about a kaleidoscope of looking at birds. When I lived in Pewaukee, I had a rainbow, blue indigo, buntings, scarlet tangers, Baltimore Oriole, the red-breasted grosbeak, all feeding under the lilac tree at one time. I used to have a garbage lid that I filled with water and kept it under their feeding station, and I'd have hawks come in and actually bathe in there, turkeys. I mean, our wildlife in Waukesha is really diverse.
Sounds great.
It sounds great. And as far as the crow is concerned, if you or anyone else can actually catch it, then a rehabilitator can do something for it in terms of setting the wing. If it regains flight, it would be released. If it doesn't, it could be used as an educational bird at a nature center or some other facility. But if it's simply left in an urban environment and a bird that can't fly is not long for this world.
Not long for this world. And thanks for calling, Melody. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the World of Wildlife with Scott Craven now. Glad to have you listening in. Annette in Dodgeville has a question for you, Scott, so let's go there. Hi, Annette.
Hi, it's Arnett. But that's
Arnett,
okay.
Sorry.
I'm about 6 miles west of Dodgeville, and I feed orioles also. And there was a bird on the oriole feeder that I at first glance thought was a bluebird, and I got out my trusty bird book, and it was an orchard oriole.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never seen one of those before. It was a little smaller and quite dark. And my bird book said it's common to this area, and I just wondered if it was.
Well, they certainly do turn up here, so most of the folks who have been enjoying the return of the orioles have been on the watch for the orchard orioles, which are a bit more unusual. So, yes, it's a possibility. You saw one.
You're lucky.
And, you know, go with your bird book in terms of the distribution and description and so forth, and that'll tell you a little bit more about it.
Well,
they are around.
I got pictures of both of them sitting on the feeder together. So.
That's cool.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks, Arnett. Mary in Clark County, on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
The other day, I have a two-story shed. The squirrels have made a nest up near the roof, of course, inside, and one of the babies fell out.
Mm-hmm.
Baby doesn't even have his eyes open yet. All the cats rushed over as if this was free lunch. So I went over, picked the little baby up, took it in the house, took it back out, tried to give it back to the squirrels. They're not interested. In fact, I think they've absconded because there's no squirrels left now. And I have this little baby squirrel in the house, been feeding it kitten formula,
mm-hmm.
which it seems to take to. But I don't know what to do with this little squirrel. Is he, you know, is kitten formula okay?
Well, I guess... Mary, the first thing I would do is find out, and if this takes a call to the local DNR service center or office, find out who in your area is around as a licensed rehabilitator. And there are many of them, many good folks scattered around the state,
as
well as nature centers. And see if you can find someone nearby who, at best, might be willing to take it in, or at the least would advise you on what you need to do to try and nurse it along. And I would... You know, if you're successful so far and the thing's hanging on, you know, keep doing what you're doing, but try and find a better home for it. In either event, if you get it up to the point where it seems to be its eyes are open and it seems to be independent, minimize your contact with it so that there's a reasonable chance you could release the animal when it gets to the point that you feel it can take care of itself or that it seems to be interested in solid food.
I only handle it just to feed it. Otherwise, I don't have.
No, and that's fine. And I think that's the right thing to do. But we've had lots of cases over the years where people have successfully reared an orphan gray squirrel and then release it. And if it's been treated as a pet and you release it, it's got some problems in reacclimating to the wild. And I remember one incident in particular where a gentleman went out in his backyard. This was in Madison, and went out in his backyard and said he saw a squirrel, and the squirrel saw him, and they stopped to glance at each other, and the next thing he knew, the squirrel made a beeline for him, jumped up on his shoe, ran up his pant leg, and before he could even react, the squirrel was sitting on his shoulder. And ultimately, the squirrel ended up and they kept it on the porch for a while. But it was clearly one that someone had raised, and the squirrel thought, "Wow, there's mom or another person," and that's not good for something in the wild. And that's why the rehabilitators are more tuned into how to do that properly and then release them successfully. So
the DNR would know who the rehabilitator is.
The people with the in the there is an association. I think if you fiddle around on the computer, you can probably Google the Wisconsin Wildlife Rehabilitators Association, and you may come up with a list of individuals and find some. In fact, Larry's working on that as we speak. You should see his fingers moving on the keyboard. It's something.
I think I misspelled it too.
It's something to see. But in any event, that might very well give you a starting point. But they are also licensed with the DNR, so that's why I suggested you perhaps start with them and then find someone locally.
Yeah, I went online and found some information right away. So if you go online, you're gonna find that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for
good
calling.
Good luck.
Jolynn in Muskego is up next, Scott. So let's go to Jolynn. Hi.
Hi. This is my first year feeding the orioles.
Yeah.
And I've been told that if I can establish them feeding at my feeders, which they are, that they will stay all summer.
They'll hang around most of the summer, but there'll be periods when they may not be as inclined to use the feeder as they are right now. But, yes, they will stay around. Larry, do you get them throughout the summer? I mean, for mine, they tend to hang around for 5-6 weeks now. Then they're nesting, and there's a period there where they may be dealing with the young, and they're not coming to the feeder.
Yeah, they're not coming to the feeder. And then I'm told, too, in July, probably you shouldn't be feeding the grape jelly anymore because of the nutritional aspects of grape jelly versus mm-hmm. other things they ought to be eating. So, you know, whether or not that's the case.
Right now, at least with mine, they seem a lot more interested in the orange halves than they are.
Man, are they eating the orange halves?
Yeah, wow. They're eating the orange halves, and oranges are a lot more expensive than grape jelly, so we got to do something about that. But, you know, I think I tend to give the birds, any of these birds or animals, perhaps more credit than sometimes
some
they
would
get in the literature. And, you know, we think that, well, we put something out, gee, it's not the best for them. Generally speaking, most animals are pretty adept at figuring out or knowing what's nutritionally advantageous for them and what isn't. So if you've got them coming in, put out some nesting material for them now, some thread and string and yarn and things like that. They appreciate that along with the food materials and see what you get. But what you will get is, I think, the same birds coming back year after year.
Yeah, they'll come
so
back.
So if you start a good tradition with your feeders, particularly in this early season period, you'll get them every spring.
May 1st. That's when they come to our feeders, May 1st.
Okay, thanks. And I just want to make a comment about the guy that's losing his tulips.
Mm-hmm.
I have hundreds of tulips planted in my yard, and just I'd look at them, and I'd know by tomorrow it's going to bloom.
Mm-hmm.
I'd walk the next day, and it would be gone. And we've actually seen our squirrels dancing around the yard with them in their mouths.
Oh, yeah.
Your squirrels.
So I think it's the squirrels.
Okay. Well, technically, just to be biologically accurate, a woodchuck is a ground squirrel, so it's all in the family.
It's all in the family. Woodchucks, squirrels, rabbits, they'll all get after those tulips. Thanks, Jolynn. Dick in Colesburg, Iowa, is up next. So let's go to Dick. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I've got to brag about having seen rose-breasted grosbeaks, which we hadn't had before. And also, I saw an indigo bunting the other day.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful bird.
Oh, they're beautiful.
And then we have the orioles are back. And we've had them for 3 or 4 years. But the question that I had was about a year ago in the winter time, we did not see what I always thought was the mourning dove.
Mm-hmm.
The mourning dove is a mauve sort of color.
Yes.
Now, mm-hmm. But what we had was a pair of real gray, and they were larger than the mourning doves. Is there another kind of dove?
Well, there was, but we haven't seen a passenger pigeon for a long, long time.
Well, that's what I thought about, but I wouldn't know a passenger pigeon if I saw one.
Well, the likelihood of seeing one is pretty remote. I think the last one died in 1919 or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. It was about a century ago. You know, I see a lot of doves at my feeders, and I would say that I would describe, if somebody asked me, hey, what color is a dove, I would have said gray to begin with, or tan or beige, and there's some variation from dove to dove, especially depending on the adults and the young. And if you see a pair in the winter, especially when they're fluffed up and all to try and stay warm in the cold, there's quite a bit of variation from dove to dove. So just on the basis, while there are other kinds of doves around North America, not in our area, although I would never rule out the chance that something had been released, escaped from a game farm or whatever. But I think what you probably saw was an adult pair of mature mourning doves fluffed up for the winter and just looked a little bit larger than normal.
Yeah. They were the only ones that I saw that winter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's probably what it was, what they were, excuse me. Dick, thanks. Thank you very much for calling. And Mark in Kenosha is up next, so let's go to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
You're fine.
I can barely hear you. I was calling about the earlier call about the pelicans.
Uh-huh.
I spent some time living right on the Mississippi River in northeastern Missouri for a long time. And a DNR person that I was associated with down there informed me that pelicans, when they appear, it's generally a good sign because it usually means that your water sources are very clean.
Yeah?
Well, probably. I mean, you know, most birds or any other animal will attempt to avoid contaminated sites and that kind of thing, or at least try to. I'm not altogether sure in terms of thinking about that large colony at the mouth of the Fox River, given some of the difficulties with sediment and whatnot in the Fox Valley that necessarily follows. But, you know, they certainly are a bird that, given a preference, are found in pristine wetlands and large marshes and lake systems. But I think if there's little option available, they would occupy sites that we might consider a little less than pristine. But
yeah.
Certainly along that site from the Mississippi River west is traditionally where the big flyway for pelicans was moving up into central Canada. But as we said, they seem to be creeping east and in pretty good numbers.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. Thank you for calling. Andrew in Amory, it is up to you now. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for calling.
All right. If you don't know where Amory is, it's in northwestern Wisconsin. And 10 years ago, I rarely saw trumpeter swans around.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems every fall I'm seeing more and more trumpeter swans. And now this spring, I actually just saw two trumpeter swans today hanging around. So I was just wondering, where are these trumpeter swans coming from? Are they expanding their numbers in Wisconsin, or what's the deal with trumpeter swans?
Yes, of course, there was a very, 15, 20 years ago, there was a very aggressive program to restore the trumpeter swan population in Wisconsin. DNR biologists and collaborators were making a routine flight up to Alaska to collect eggs, and they were hatched out at the Milwaukee Zoo, and there was quite a bit of a research effort associated with moving these introduced trumpeter swans around the state to rebuild Wisconsin's. This was, again, a native species that we wanted back. And the bottom line is, your assessment is correct. The program's been doing very well. The swans have been doing very well. And while they're not a common bird by any means, I think everybody, by all measure, the restoration program was a big success. So is an opportunity to see them. There still should be some around that are marked, of course. So if you see any with neck bands or any other marking, that would be something you should report to your local DNR office, and that'll get back to the team responsible for them. But I'm reluctant to bring this up, but you're absolutely sure what you're seeing. Of course, there are a lot of swans in general. The vast majority, of course, are tundra swans. But you know the difference. You know what you're up to here, right?
Yep, exactly.
Okay. All right, fine. Then there's no question about it. You know, they're around, and I forget the actual numbers, but I think we're dealing with over 100 pairs or more in the state now. You know, and from zero, that's a pretty good situation.
Yeah. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
Mary in Madison is up next. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I had taken a ride up to the Baraboo Hills.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I was on a steep hill, and there, on the left-hand side of the road, there was all oak woods and pine, and then it descended into hemlocks and, a steep ravine situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no sooner pulled over and consulting the map before I would had gone into the woods, and I saw this bushy tail and this mound of fur moving, and I guess the window attracted, I lowered the window, and it attracted the head to come looking at me, and it was a badger.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
Yeah, I was thrilled. And
You don't sound thrilled, Mary. Were you thrilled, or were you a little nervous?
No, I was thrilled.
Okay.
I was in the car.
Okay.
And I had heard from another person that they make a hissing sound.
Sometimes.
Yeah, they do.
Well, anyways, it turned to look at me, and then it put its nose to the ground and was foraging, and then it looked at me again, and went foraging, and then it just decided to go in this hole in the bank there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering the power of smell, and I saw a lot of acorns on the ground in the woods and some early spring ephemerals and some skunk cabbage down by the ravine. But what would it smell? And what would it eat at this time of year? And how much, how many acres would it need to, I assume they're solitary.
Yeah. You don't want to be too close to them during the rainy season. They're not the best-smelling animals in the world.
Well, they, as mustelids or members of the weasel family, have their own musky smell to them, but their sense, I'm not sure whether you're talking about their smell or their sense of smell, but their sense of smell is also very keen because they are carnivores. I mean, they're meat eaters, not very interested in skunk cabbage or spring ephemerals or even acorns, although they might eat a nut or whatnot, but far more interested in chipmunks, ground squirrels, and assorted other things it might dig up along that cut bank that you saw it on. They're terrific diggers, and they find these underground mammals or snakes or other sources of food, meat basically, with their sense of smell, and then they're quite capable of digging these things out of their dens or burrows, and that's the end of the line for any ground squirrel they get a hold of. So by foraging, it was rummaging around. It was looking for something like that to dig up, catch, and eat. And in terms of acres to support one, they're found over most of the state, but very uncommonly. I've never seen a live one in the wild, although I've seen some dead along the road. So you were lucky to see one.
I know.
And, you know, I think it depends a lot on the quality of habitat and the quality of the food source, but you could go for hundreds of acres or even sections or square miles and not find another badger. Now, whether they're occupying all of that territory, probably not, but they're certainly not densely populated by any means.
No. And so you were lucky, Mary.
Yep.
And thanks for reporting it to us. Appreciate it. The number to call, by the way, for you to join in is 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Dan in Sharon, Wisconsin is up next. Dan, hello.
Okay, how are you?
Great.
I have probably a strange question.
That's
23
our
years ago, my son was visiting my brother on Lake Wisconsin, and he brought home a mud turtle.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the size of a half dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's about the size of a dessert plate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he's 29, and he don't want this mud turtle.
Mm-hmm.
Can I take this turtle back to where it came from, and will it survive?
Hmm.
Well, you know, a turtle is a pretty durable animal. And for a turtle, life is kind of perpetually in the slow lane. They don't need a lot of skills to survive. If they're in suitable habitat and can root around and occasionally find a dead fish or snail or something else they can tackle, their food needs are relatively limited, and they would hibernate right in the pond or lake they're in. The only issue with, I had a very similar call from a person with a turtle that they had picked up years ago in the Wisconsin River just a few weeks ago and had decided they wanted to release it. And we checked with the herpetologist on the DNR staff. And the only concern, is more for something else other than the turtle, and that is whether the turtle has been held in isolation such that there's really no risk that it's been exposed to any other reptiles or other turtles, so that by replacing the turtle, the turtle does fine, but the turtle may carry with it some parasite or disease organism that could be a problem for other turtles. And the decision was that in the case of the other turtle, no, it's been in a tank in the basement for 10 years or whatever, you know, completely isolated. Then the decision was fine, let it go where it was captured. And the odds are pretty good that the turtle will be fine as long as you're comfortable in your own mind that you're not potentially exposing.
Well, it's been well taken care of for 23 years.
Yeah,
you know.
And obviously if you've had it for 23 years, it's been well fed and cared for. So my inclination is to say if you know where it came from, take it back and let it go, and the odds are pretty good. I would at least try and find an area, you know, don't let it go on a public beach, for example.
Oh, no.
Because without any fear of or concern about people,
Yeah.
It's going to be picked up fairly quickly, and it may fall into hands who are not going to be as caring as you've been.
Yeah, right.
But I would say find an isolated area and let it go.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. The old mud turtle might be happy to be out after 23 years.
I can only imagine, well, 23 years here I've been in this tank and finally back in Lake Wisconsin.
Joe in Belleville, it is your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I've got a question about the Prairie River up mm-hmm. in Lincoln County.
Yeah.
Yep.
I fish it quite a bit and just have caught no trout there the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I was told that the last few years have been too dry and too hot to produce eggs and good spawning. And is that something that's happening lately in Wisconsin statewide?
I don't think so.
Not
statewide. I think not statewide, certainly, and there may be some conditions on some stretches of the prairie, but, you know, the prairie was just the source of a considerable amount of controversy over regulations for trout fishing on the Prairie River about whether it should be, you know, fly fishing only, bait should be allowed, can you keep fish, do you have to release them? And there were some pretty strong opinions on both sides with people who said, gee, you know, we'd really like to keep a few fish for dinner, we'd like to be able to use bait versus the fly fishermen. And the Prairie River, among all the trout streams, maybe next to the Brule in Wisconsin, has quite the reputation, and I think it's still the holder of the state record brook trout from many years gone by.
Right.
So I hadn't heard about any particular dilemma facing the prairie as far as declining trout populations. In fact, if you read the dialogue about people fishing it and trying to distribute the resource, I just didn't get the sense that there was a real problem going on. But I would direct that question. You know, it's really not my area of expertise, but certainly the local DNR fish manager who has responsibility for the prairie could tell you exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And or the cold water fisheries specialist for the DNR here in Madison. And you could probably get the straight lowdown on their survey results per mile of stream and whatever else,
sure.
whatever other data they have.
All right. Thank you. One more question.
Sure.
We have a bet here. I say that your guest is a youper, and my father said he's way too smart to be a youper, and he must be Canadian.
No, you're both wrong.
not Canadian and not a youper, although I've spent a fair bit of time in Canada and a little bit of time in the UP, but not very much. But no, my origins are in the great state of New Hampshire on the seacoast of New England.
Oh, that explains it
but
then.
That was a long,
that was a long time ago.
Yeah, the pilgrims had just, well, anyway, that's another story.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. How long have you been here, Scott? 30 years?
1972.
Yeah, more than 30.
36 years.
36 long years.
No, they've been good years. They've been good years. I like Wisconsin. If I hadn't, I'm sort of like that turtle, I guess, that's been in the basement. I'm disinclined to leave.
Well, you and I are a lot alike in that regard. Shirley and Prentice, it's your turn. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, thanks, Larry. I've got a few questions about bats, which I haven't heard anybody ask. When do they come back to northern Wisconsin?
Well, in many cases, they never left.
They never left.
Some of our species either overwinter in buildings, if they can find a suitable building, in a church belfry, so to speak, municipal buildings, places that have a suitable temperature regime, they'll overwinter in those buildings and then disperse back to summer roosts in the spring. Others will move short distances to some of the major hibernacular or wintering sites around the Midwest, like the Nita Mine in west central Wisconsin near Horicon that houses hundreds of thousands of bats. And others, like the solitary species like red bats, which are tree bats rather than roost or communal bats, actually migrate like birds. And some of them will hang around and remain active even up through Thanksgiving or so. And then we've had students who have reported seeing active red bats as early as February or March in warm weather. Mm. So regardless of whether they're only coming from the neighbor's attic, a big mine or cave somewhere, or whether they're coming back with the birds, they should all be back and active by now.
Mm. My problem is I found a dead baby bat on the ground floor of my house. I took it out and then saw an adult bat fly near the house. This was at noon yesterday. So Does a mother ever find the baby, or do they get together again? I remember in Austin, Texas, under that bridge.
Under the Congress Avenue Bridge.
Hundreds of babies on the ground, you know, and I wondered, well, they'll never get back together with the...
If a baby bat hits the ground, it's pretty much a goner. But it's incredibly early. Tell me how you know this was... I mean, was it just a tiny little thing?
Yeah, it was a tiny little thing, and it was...
Tiny like fingernail size?
No, not that tiny, like a quarter maybe.
But it was alive?
No, it was dead.
It was dead?
Dead.
Freshly dead, or?
I think so, because it felt quite soft. And I mean, I've been up and down the steps, and I mean, and I've been going down to the ground floor, and I hadn't seen it before, and I do kind of watch where I'm walking. Well, there's a few dead ladybugs around there. I got to...
Typically, bats are very... low-output reproducers. They only have one young per female per year, and they take pretty darn good care of them, and it's incredibly early for a young bat to be outside of the maternal roost. Generally, we consider June and July to be the periods of birth. So it's very early for a youngster to be out, but it's possible. I mean, a red bat is the one exception. That's the tree bat that I mentioned, the solitary species. They might have two or three young. And in that case, the young actually fly attached to the holding on to the female for dear life. And I have seen cases where people have found either a grounded red bat with a couple young attached hanging on. It gets to the point where she just can't fly with that kind of weight. And then she might leave the young and then come back and nurse them. But, I'm not sure what to tell you here. If it was a red bat, I mean, about all you can do is put it in a place where maybe it's a case where the female is going to come back. If it's a young bat that actually originated in your attic or a wall void in a more traditional roost colony, then I think it's probably a goner. Well, it is a goner. It is a goner.
It's,
it was dead anyway.
Gone.
But I guess I'd be, if I were you, I'd be concerned about what was going on in your attic or wall void and, you know, maybe think about an inspection to see what kind of a colony or bat activity you have there. You may not have any at all, depending on what kind of a bat it was. The other thing is we do have a couple of very small species. The pipistrel, for example, is a tiny little bat, even in adult form. And, I mean, did it look like a baby? In other words, not much hair? Or did it just look like a small bat?
It looked like a... That was a
stupid question on my part, but what I'm getting at is it's possible, depending on the size you describe, that it could have been an adult bat of one of the smaller species.
Oh.
There you go.
And we're just not going to know that. Unless you have the specimen or can send us a picture or something else, we're not going to figure this out. But I would at least check your house to see if there's any issue with the colony. And then beyond that, not much you can do.
No. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, our guest. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'd love to hear from you. And Scott, just before we go to Joe in Bailey's Harbor, I wanted to bring up this Covert's Workshop that is being held.
Well, it's that time of year when I need to plug the Covert's Workshop. Coverts or covert, it's an old English term that describes a dense thicket that provides shelter for wildlife, but it's the name given to a national woodland wildlife management program for private landowners that my colleagues and I at the university have been running now for about 15 years. The workshop this year is August 14th to the 17th, and it's up at Kemp Station on Lake Tomahawk.
Beautiful place.
Beautiful place for 3 days. It's sponsored primarily by the Ruffed Grouse Society, but also by a number of other donors. And we bring in 25 landowners who are interested in not only better management of their own property, but are willing to become ambassadors for good, sound woodland stewardship and reach out to others, neighbors, friends, family members, what have you. And it's an application process, and we will pick 25 folks to attend. It's underwritten by the Grouse Society, so there's no cost other than getting there to the participants. We'll feed them very well. It's a lovely place to stay, and they'll go through essentially 3 full days of field activities, classroom lectures and discussions.
Sounds like
a couple
fun.
Of tours. It's a great thing. I mean, we've had some really wonderful people in there over the years, and they have a good time, and we all get to know each other, and it's just a really neat thing. And And again, that's in mid-August this year, about a week earlier than normal to accommodate some other things going on. And it will be up at Kemp, which, you know, 3 days at Kemp is just a good thing.
Man.
Even if you're not learning all sorts of good stuff. But they'll get a big binder with all sorts of resources on woodland wildlife management and forest management. Bottom line is, if you own some woodland in Wisconsin, and this is something that piques your interest, you should email my colleague Jamie Knack for an application. And those are due June 15th. Get them in and, you know, mention on the application you heard about it on the radio, and we'd like to know, you know, how that plays out in terms of promotion. Jamie's email address is jlnack, N-A-C-K, so it's jlnack at wisc.edu. So the Standard University email address and jlnack. And she'll send you out an application, get that back to us, and we'll give it due consideration. But it's a...
Do you do the cooking on any of that? Or
I do all the
cooking.
Yes.
Scott's a really good cook, too. I can tell you that.
I do the cooking and some of the programs and field activities, and Jamie coordinates the whole thing, does a great job at that. It's just a great thing all the way around. Some really neat DNR folks and other agency folks and Rough Grouse Society biologists come in and provide a lot of useful information, so... There
sounds,
you go.
Sounds like fun. And it's jlnack
at
wisc.edu.
Yes.
All right. Let's go to Joe in Bailey's Harbor now. Joe, hello. Joe, are you there? Let's see. Did we lose Joe?
I don't know. I wish I was in Bailey's Harbor, though.
Maybe we lost you.
I'll be doing a lecture in Bailey's Harbor, too, in mid-July. I'm trying to remember the date. It's a Thursday night. Might as well plug a lot of things while we're on the subject.
Yeah.
At the Ridges Sanctuary in mid-July, so we'll be talking about reptiles and amphibians on a Thursday night.
Well, I think we lost Joe, so let's go to Dan. Let's see if Dan's there. Dan, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a kind of a follow-up comment question concerning the pelicans.
Okay.
I live in the Green Bay area, and I'm wondering if the return of the pelicans is kind of related to the zebra mussels. It seemed that we started seeing them about 10 years ago, and maybe the clarity of the water more than the quality of the water had something to do with it.
That's a possibility, I suppose. I hadn't heard that association or thought about it, but it's a possibility. You know, there are other considerations there. You know, at the time that the pelican population was booming there on, I think it's Lone Tree Island or whatever it's called in the mouth of the harbor, the cormorant population on neighboring Cat Island was also booming, and you know, I think there are other reasons for the cormorant increase. They feed, you know, in many similar ways.
Yeah.
And there wasn't, I don't think there was any relationship with clarity issues as far as the cormorants were concerned. I'm not sure. It's an interesting theory, though, Dan. There are probably some folks listening, as they usually are, who may take that to heart. And I'll mention it to some of the folks who are working on colonial birds in that area, but I simply don't know whether there's any cause and effect relation there or not.
Interesting idea, though. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. Let's go back to Joe in Bailey's Harbor. Joe, hello.
Hello. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
We can.
Okay. I have just two quick questions for you. Is there timber rattlers in Wisconsin, actually?
Yes, there are. They're primarily relegated to the western fringe of the state, from about mid-state down to the corner there in Grant County, and they're primarily associated with the Mississippi River and the Wisconsin River and the bluffs and rocky country along those rivers. So they are there, but you know, their populations are depleted. They were given legal protection in the state a few years ago as a protected wild animal, and there have been lots of efforts underway to try and conserve what remaining timber rattlesnake populations we have.
Oh, okay. And my second question, we're up here in beautiful Door County in Bailey's Harbor, and I have a friend that we've been seeing some birds here this spring. He claims that they're red-breasted nut scratchers.
Red-breasted nut hatches. There is a bird called the red-breasted nut hatch, yes.
And that's
close enough.
That's close enough. All right. So there you have it, Joel. Christy at Oconomowoc. Let's go to you. Hi, Christy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling in response to the woman who is taking care of that little baby squirrel.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a little baby squirrel in my backyard once that...
wound up with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was apparently injured from something, I don't know what, and I discovered her under a bush, and she actually had one eye, and I kind of fondly referred to her as my one-eyed Susie, because I happened to be planning Black Eyed Susie since the day that I had met her. And so I started just feeding her, but I never touched her. And then she took up residence in an old birdhouse that was very near my deck, and I have a dog who has taken it upon herself to be a little bit of a huntress. And I was very concerned about this squirrel living there and knowing my dog would get after her sooner or later. So one day when she wasn't home, I was watching for her not to be home, and I closed up her little birdhouse so she finds another place to live. And I hadn't seen her for quite a while, but she would approach me very often. And I was always concerned about my dog. Now, she must have known that I was feeding her and taken it upon herself to think of me as her mama, I guess. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could well be. I mean, we can do a little speculating on that. We need to take a little break here for the news and weather. And when we come back, we'll maybe speculate a little bit on that. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Pleased to have him along. And Scott, we've talked in the past and just recently here about squirrels, a baby squirrel that somebody finds and they feed him. And even if they are careful about it, those squirrels can become, if they're babies, can become attached to humans, and that's probably not a good thing.
No, it's not a good thing, but, of course, we always are sensitive to people's concern over individual animals.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, wildlife managers have to be concerned about the well-being of the population, the individuals take a little less precedent. But nevertheless, people do get concerned about this kind of thing, but I think it's good, solid advice this time of year as we enter. Somebody called and said there were goslings out already, and there'll be other baby animals out shortly. But the basic guideline is that baby animals belong in the wild, and that while they often look orphaned or in distress, more often than not, they're not. Mm-hmm. And if you leave them alone or at least move them out of harm's way, a brood of ducklings that's caught on a curb or about to go down a storm drain or something, then intervention is necessary. Get them across a road or over the curb or something. But for the most part, other than avoiding immediate danger, the best policy is to leave those things around. And the parent animals are usually present or will be shortly. In some cases, the parents, in the case of nestling rabbits, for example, don't even visit the young ones during the day. It's at night.
Yeah.
So the best course of action, although it's sometimes hard for people, is to leave them. And yes, certainly some of them won't make it. But most of these animals produce way more young than are needed to replace themselves. And,
yep.
Well,
it
seems a little harsh, but there you have it.
Jeff in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question about kingfishers. I go out and help the DNR during the spring feeding the salmon out at Strawberry Creek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're not going to believe this, but kingfishers like to get in that pond.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it on a pretty regular basis. And yesterday I had a situation where there were two in the pond in the afternoon. One was an obvious adult flying around, but there was another one in the water. And it didn't seem to be able to fly. It was just sort of flopping around on top of the water. And I eventually had to net it out of the pond because it looked like it was getting tired and weak.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got it out into the grass and in the sun, it looked a little shocky and scared, so I put a blanket over it to let it calm down. And eventually it was able to fly a little ways away and go into Strawberry Creek. And the last I saw it, it was standing on the shore, but it couldn't fly. And I'm just wondering, would that be a juvenile already?
Wow, it seems, but you're sure it was a kingfisher?
Oh, absolutely.
No question about it being a kingfisher. It seems more likely to me. That's awfully early.
Yeah.
Right.
So it seems more likely that it was, I mean, we don't doubt that it was a kingfisher, but more likely one that was in some distress,
right,
unrelated to its age, that it hit an overhead wire, or it, you know, dove into what it thought was,
yeah,
12 inches of water, but there was only 1 inch or something. Either that or it was debilitated in some other way by disease or parasite. Who knows what?
Okay.
But in some way it was compromised in terms of its health, and you know, you did a good thing by trying to warm it up. If a bird hits a window, for example, that's exactly what you do, is keep it calm and warm, and unless they're seriously injured, they'll usually come around, snap out of it, and go about their business. But it sounds to me like this one, the way it behaved, even when it had been given a chance to dry out and calm down, that there was something else going on other than just a juvenile.
Well, I know it's the kingfishers because they get in there all the time, and mm-hmm, you know, yeah. But what happens? The other thing possibly is because the pond is netted. They hit the net when they panic when they see me,
mm-hmm, yeah,
and they keep flying back and forth and hitting in the net. And I thought maybe it had injured itself, but I really couldn't tell. I mean,
yeah.
Well, that's certainly a plausible explanation, and you know, it went off, and hopefully it recovers and goes about its business. But you did all you could.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling and for your work with the DNR. Appreciate that, too. Michelle in Manitowoc, it is your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Hello.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for
you? I have rabbits living under my deck.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, we'd like to put some lattice around the deck so that they can't get in there.
Yeah.
But I don't want a chance trapping any babies.
Mm-hmm.
So when do they have their babies, and how long after they have them do they leave the nest and we could put the lattice up?
See, I thought you said lettuce and you were trying to feed them, but since you're trying to exclude them, I guess there are a couple of options. First of all, rabbits start reproducing as early as March, and they pretty much breed nonstop into early fall.
Oh.
So because there's enough variation from rabbit to rabbit and the breeding season is so protracted, and any given adult female might end up having multiple, 4 or 5 litters by the time the breeding season is over with, I don't believe there's a time that we could say with any certainty there would be no baby rabbits under there. So I think what you're going to have to do is either start the lattice work and leave one opening, such that the rabbits can come and go, and then whenever you feel comfortable enough that you haven't seen any young ones for a while or there's not much activity, that you can either close it completely or you can leave essentially a one-way door so that they can get out and not back in. The only other thing, I don't know what's under the deck, but if it's fairly open and you or someone else can crawl under there and look around or clean things up before you seal it off with the lattice, to be relatively certain that there are no young under there. That's really about all you can do.
Yep.
And if they're old enough that they can either move on their own or ready to be weaned, or the female can move them, you could encourage them out before you do the final sealing by throwing a handful of naphthalene mothballs under there. Most mammals find the smell of those mothballs objectionable, and that might give a female a couple of days to move the young out of there, if there are any left.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you, Michelle. Loretta in Eau Claire, it's your turn now. Hi, Loretta.
Hi, Larry and Scott. We have a small barn, and there's a phoebe that just thinks that would be the best place, but we close it too much for that to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, could we put a platform on a tree right outside of the barn, or what does it really want?
Well, you know, they like to be up under eaves or on a deck support or something like that. So I would certainly not encourage them to be inside where they might be trapped. So if you can close that up, the bird's either going to find another suitable site or it isn't.
Yeah.
And if you want to encourage it, then check publications like our Shelves, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Mammals, a UW Extension publication, and there are plenty of ideas in there for nest platforms that you could actually put right on the side of the shed under the eaves, for that matter.
Yeah.
And that's a better site for birds like that than putting it on a tree, which is then accessible to squirrels and raccoons and things like that that are potential nest predators.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks so much.
Okay. Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Scott, we've got the Horicon Marsh Bird Festival coming up May 9th through the 12th. It's the 11th annual. And, you know, it's just worth talking about that it's a great place to go. Lots of great activities going on there. And
you know, I was going to say if it's a nice weekend, but it really doesn't matter. Horicon's a lovely place, even if the weather's not ideal. But there are all sorts of events and birding trips and lectures and other things associated with that. People can go to Horicon Marsh Bird Fest, all one giant word.com. And find out what the schedule of events is. So, you know, a neat way to spend one of the days or an afternoon this coming weekend. Mm-hmm. And shortly thereafter, and in relation to this, Migratory Bird Day is coming up. There'll be events at other sites around the state in recognition of all of the warblers and other birds that are migrating back this time of year. So, yeah, the Bird Fest is one of many neat spring things to do.
And what about the Conservation Congress?
Well, you know, that vote took place, or the votes that occurred at the Conservation Congress took place a couple of weeks ago now. I think the dust has settled on such issues as planning for a wolf hunt, which was a little bit contentious. Some of the deer votes that were there. There was a vote related, we talked earlier, about woodland owners and our coverts project. There was some concern over potential change in the managed forest law, restrictions on opening lands to public access. In most cases, the votes went as expected, and those votes or the results of that public input process now will find their way to the Natural Resources Board or the DNR, and they'll take that into account as they create new regulations and policies. So it's an interesting exercise in conservation democracy in the state, and it's over for another year.
Tom in Daggett, Michigan, I believe, is next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good afternoon. Last week, I observed a pair of eagles over the Menominee River doing what I assume was like the mating swoop or dive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're large birds, but they appear to be immature. And I was just wondering if they practice that technique or what exactly I was watching.
Well, practice makes perfect. And I assume that, you know, it takes them about 4 years to develop the white head and tail feathers and so forth where they'd be in breeding condition. But you know, juvenile. So it's quite possible that these were perhaps 1 year removed from that, and just as you suggest, kind of getting the general feel of things.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot. Leslie in Preston, Minnesota. You are up. Hello, Leslie.
Hi, guys. I have a question about beavers, but first I just wanted to say that this morning when I got up and came out into the kitchen, it was dark outside, and I had the light on in the kitchen, but I could hear a weird noise. It kind of sounded like a sick crow, kind of. I don't know how to explain it. But I looked out the window. I got right up next to the window and looked out, and it was a fox right in my front yard making like a barking noise, and it went around to the side of the house, and I went to where a window was open. It went on that side of the house, and I could hear it really well. And that's just a kind of a cool, not a bark, but I guess it's a bark.
Yeah. Well, it is a bark. They're a member of the dog family, and they bark at each other and communicate with the pups, and there might have even been pups out already.
We've seen three pups.
Well, there you go.
Good for you.
But they're around, yeah. My question is, we live on a river, and the beavers are just raising havoc with everything. They've been chewing big pine trees and girdling oak trees and cutting down the sand willow. So we used to have just tons of sand willow, and it's just like gone.
Mm-hmm.
We've never seen it gone before. This year we're just inundated with beavers. What can we do?
Well, you're calling from Minnesota, so I can't give you some of the counsel that I might based on Wisconsin regulations or people in Wisconsin to call. But there is a USDA Wildlife Services program in Minnesota. And you can track them down through the Minnesota DNR, and you can go through the Minnesota DNR as well. What you need to find out is the analog from Minnesota to the Wisconsin Beaver Management Guidelines, which pretty much allow a landowner to do just about anything they want with beaver in recognition of their population levels currently. And in some cases, depending on whether it's a trout stream or it's a threat to the waterway in terms of damming or flooding or there's a road at issue, then the Wildlife Services people may be able to either certainly provide advice, but maybe actually be able to come in and remove some animals. In the meantime, while you're tracking down what help or what legal status you have or don't have in Minnesota, you can certainly protect some trees on your property by essentially armor plating them is what you have to do. And you need to make either a hardware cloth or a welded wire cylinder to essentially go around the trunk area and protect trees that you absolutely positively don't want those beavers gnawing on. And that essentially is all you can do until you find out under Minnesota regulation whether you can trap the animals, shoot the animals, destroy their dens, or what other options you have.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Judy in Platteville, on to you now. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I was calling to describe something that has occurred in our yard that has been suggested were pocket gophers. We live in the township, and we're adjacent to old pasture land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've always had moles for 20-plus years, and we live with them. But last fall, I remember looking out the window, and I saw these little cone-shaped dirt piles. Mm-hmm. They were about 9 to 12 inches high, mm-hmm. and they just appeared. It was out my kitchen window, which I look out frequently, like they weren't there, and then they were.
Mm-hmm.
We have more of these right now coming, and can you give me a definition or a description of...
Well, if you saw the animals, they're rather distinctively different, but you're unlikely to see the animals. You're south of the Wisconsin River, is that correct?
Yes.
So that means it's less likely that they're pocket gophers, which are generally thought to be pretty much restricted by the Wisconsin River to north and south. For example, they're very common in Spring Green on the north side of the river, but almost non-existent on the other side.
Okay.
That's a possibility, but the way you tell the mounds apart is that the mole pushes the soil out of its mound straight up and down. So you end up with exactly what you described, a little cone-like mound of soil that looks kind of like a soil volcano.
Okay,
and
yes.
The soil cascades down, and the mound is actually quite symmetrical or cone-shaped. Pocket gophers, on the other hand, push the soil out by moving backwards and kicking it out with their hind feet from a tunnel that's at a 45-degree angle, roughly.
Okay.
So they kick the dirt out, so the appearance of the mound is heart-shaped or fan-shaped, and then right at the middle, if you think of a heart and you look at the kind of the junction of the two lobes at the top, right at the junction of those two lobes, there'd be a little plug of dirt where the pocket gopher pushes up some soil to plug the hole that it just used to kick the soil out.
Mm.
And that's, if you get the hang of it or look it up online or in a field guide, you can tell very quickly just by looking at the pile of dirt whether it's a pocket gopher or a mole. There's no plugged hole in the case of the mole mound because they're pushing the soil up and it's cascading down. So there's no hole, essentially.
Okay.
But if you find the plug at that little junction, you can actually take a stick or a piece of wire or something and probe down in there, and you'll feel where that breaks into the pocket gopher tunnel right underneath that little plug. The pocket gophers are rodents, and they can be dealt with in a variety of ways. There are good traps. There are also poison baits that can be used. A mole, on the other hand, is not a rodent. They feed entirely on earthworms, beetle larvae, and things like that. Toxicants are difficult to use, but there are some other alternatives like castor oil sprays, and there's also a pretty effective mole trap called a harpoon trap as well. But you really need to figure out which one you have for sure.
Okay.
And it sounds like moles.
It would be, I guess I'm not as concerned because, as I said, we've lived with these moles for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But is it correct that the pocket gophers can get underneath concrete, like in a shed or something, and do some damage?
Well, the pocket gophers do a little more digging, and they're more of a problem in, say, a hay field or whatnot where the machinery has problems with the burrows and the mounds. But either case, if they're kind of out in the wide open spaces, I don't think you need to worry a whole lot about either one really causing the kind of digging damage or excavation that a woodchuck might cause.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Judy. Melody in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Mel.
Hi there. I live in Milwaukee, and on my walks with my dogs, I've come across a goose that is nesting in a tree, and she's about 10 feet up, and I'm just wondering about the goslings, how they're going to get down.
They will jump.
Oh, they're not going to break their little legs, are they?
No, they're pretty flexible little things, and it's not unlike a wood duck that might be 30 or 40 feet up in a tree. And when the time comes and the female calls the young ones out, they just bail out of the cavity or a wood duck box and bounce down the tree and bounce a couple times when they hit the ground, and away they go.
Oh, okay.
So they're essentially lightweight little fuzz balls, and they're pretty resilient.
Okay, good.
And it's not
stand around and try to net them or something.
No, you don't have to. Don't worry about that. No. It's a little uncommon, and it seems weird to see a big old goose up in the crotch of a tree, but they do nest off the ground on occasion.
Yeah?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mel. Steve in Viroqua is up next. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I've got a quick question for you. Brother-in-law caught a walleye through the ice late last November, and I flayed it and everything, but on the outside of the fish, it was covered in these, looked like little marbles from, you know, tan color to dark brown, and hard as a rock, too. Have you heard of anything like that?
Attached to the scales?
Right.
Hmm.
It was something just hanging on, or was it something that was, when you filleted it, did you see something in the tissue?
Nope, there was nothing in the tissue at all, and I took a flay knife and tried to, you know, stab them a few times. Like I said, they're just hard as a rock. And they didn't look like snails or anything else. Just looked like a type of growth that had grown out of the skin.
That doesn't ring a bell.
That doesn't ring a bell with me. I don't catch all that many walleyes,
right,
unfortunately. But I simply don't know. I think, did you by any chance take a picture of them or anything?
No, but after I filleted it, I kept the head and the skin and everything with everything attached to it. I've had it in my freezer since then.
Well, I think if you have a chance to stop by, where were you? You were calling from
Viroqua. Yeah.
I'm not sure where the nearest DNR office is to you, but if that got to any DNR office, they would be able to find out through the fish managers what it is, and they might be curious about it too.
Okay. Well, we've got a local office here. I believe it's in a courthouse. I'll call over there and.
Yep.
And yeah, I've just kind of been waiting to catch you and see if you had any thought on it. Well, I'll do that right away then.
Okay,
yeah,
good. Thank you.
Yeah, let us know.
I sure will.
Yeah, appreciate it very much, Steve. Thank you very much for calling. Scott, the cougar, we should probably deal with that. We got a couple callers online, but I promise we deal with the cougar situation and the timeline on the Milton cougar winding up in Chicago.
Well, it was an interesting kind of a CSI-like story, Larry. And, you know, the first sighting was north of Milton in Rock County back on the 4th of January. And then there was the sighting that really got things going where the farmer found the thing in an old barn on the 18th of January. And then ultimately, that genetic analysis of that particular sighting through a small drop of blood they found determined that it was a cougar. That was the first interesting news. Second interesting news was that, oh, it seemed to be wild genetic stock, so it was a wild cougar. And then, interestingly enough, there were a series of track records right on through January and then into early March, kind of moving around southeastern Wisconsin, generally headed southeast. And then, lo and behold, on the 14th of April, a cougar was shot in Chicago after several sightings of cougar. You know, we've had scads of them over the years, and sometimes we dismiss them, sometimes we don't. But clearly these people were seeing tracks, and then in Chicago they were seeing a cougar. So now, then the genetic results just came back a week or so ago that, same cougar. So here it got its start in Janesville, ended up shot in Chicago, and probably came, based on genetic analysis, from the Black Hills of South Dakota, 800 miles west of here.
800 miles. Scott, always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your next visit, the first Wednesday of June.
There you have it.
Thanks. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. He'll be back. We'll do this again. Jim Packard will be filling in for me for a few days, and tomorrow he talks with Chad Spade of Madison, John Viner of Mount Horeb about home renovation and repair. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.